Disclaimer notice. The views presented in this program may not reflect the views of the University of Connecticut, WHUS Radio, or the staff of the station. Some content may not be suitable for all audiences. If you are listening and would like to get involved, you can follow Instagram at Medical Minds Matter or our chapter at MMM_UConn. Hi everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Listening to Medical Minds. My name is Keshav, and I will be one of the hosts of the show going forward. I'm the events coordinator of Medical Minds Matter.
Hi everyone, my name is Ashika, and I will be also one of the hosts of the show.
Today we have a very special guest with us, Dr. Ryan Talbert, a sociology professor of mental illness at UConn. Dr. Talbert, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Ryan Talbert. I am an assistant professor of sociology here at UConn, and sort of a primary goal of my research program is to investigate the social causes of health disparities, particularly those by race. And so part of what sort of aligns with my interest on this podcast would be sort of factors that impact a person's mental health and mental well-being.
We definitely see a lot of that in the course that I'm actually part of. Dr. Talbert is one of my professors for the sociology of mental illness, and we talk a lot about the medicalization of mental illness and its history in that approach, and how looking at it through the sociological perspective can really enhance our understanding such a important issue in today's world. So I know you touched briefly on this, Dr. Talbert, but could you provide kind of an overview of your course and your research on the sociology of mental illness and its significance? How does the sociology of mental illness differ from other approaches to studying mental health?
Sure. So think of sociology as the scientific study of society as well as the social causes and consequences of human behavior. And so the sociology of mental illness is most interested in what is it about sort of our environments, where we work, where we live, where we play, that matters for a person's mental health. And the sociology of mental health typically diverges from the biomedical model in that it focuses on, first, the idea that illness is socially constructed as opposed to having to be some sort of objective reality, that we all as humans can identify, let's say, mental illness or poor mental health in others based on the degree to which a person's affect, behavior, cognition sort of align with normative dimensions of, let's say, existing. And so in the course, partly what I'm interested in doing is expanding students' understanding of sort of how society factors into people's mental health and mental well-being. So in other words, what is it about where we live, where we work, where we play, where we worship that factors into a person's sort of psychological adjustment? And the class that you're talking about, Keshav, I believe this is the fourth or fifth semester that I have taught sociology of mental illness. And I arrived at UConn in fall 2020. And when I arrived, the course had not been offered for several years. But it turns out to be a pretty popular course, in part because of growing awareness of mental illness, growing awareness of poor mental health. And from my experience, it tends to fill really quickly, such that it's a popular course. And partly what's going on there is people want to know sort of what is it that matters for our mental health? What is predicting our mental health? How do we explain, let's say, changes in patterns of mental disorder over time? And so key takeaways would be understanding, again, how environmental factors impact a person's mental health, but also the idea that the label of receiving a diagnosis can matter to a greater degree than even the consequences of having poor mental health. In other words, the label that we apply to folks with mental illness has consequences sociologically, psychologically, as well as economically.
I think that's just very relevant to definitely with the student experience. Personally, I've seen it with this organization that Ishika and I are part of, we do really focus in on the medical profession, but also it's important that we look at the medical profession starting from the student life. And so that starts with college activities, being stressed with exams and such. And it's in class really valuable to hear that there are factors, environmental factors, societal factors that are also these types of stressors.
I agree. I think it's so important also to be around people that also go through the same thing. I think it's comforting in a sense where you're with someone who might be also going into the medical profession. And you're like, oh, you're going through the same thing I am. And it's good to see that in taking a class like that too.
What inspired you to teach this course?
So I would say maybe two reasons leading to me teaching this course. The first would be, again, that it wasn't offered, let's say, prior to fall 2020 at UConn. And so coming in with some expertise in mental health and mental illness, my own research interests aligned with sort of the course material, thinking about theories, concepts, and how we explain people's mental health. So part of what motivates me to teach this course, again, is sort of my own research, but also the fact that it wasn't offered. And then maybe a third reason might be that sort of growing awareness of mental health and the importance of mental health and knowing how to cope, knowing how to take care of yourself psychologically. I think that aligns really well with, in some ways, what students want to learn. In other words, what it's sort of identifying that in some cases our mental health can be in our control, but in other ways, there are factors beyond our individual control that can sort of shape a person's mental health. And so disseminating that information in a class like sociology of mental illness propelled me to teach the course and to teach it pretty regularly here at UConn.
You touched a bit on the types of information that students may be exposed to or not exposed to regarding mental illness. And I know that relates a lot to what we talked about with our perception and stigmas around mental health. You even talked about how sometimes the consequences of labeling can outweigh the effects of having a mental illness, leading to more of the cultural and social influences. In what ways does our culture influence our perceptions and stigmas around mental illness from a sociological standpoint?
Sure. So again, think of sociology as trying to identify what it is about society that matters, in this case, for a person's psychological adjustment. And so you could think of culture as some sociologists define it as agreed upon systems of meaning. But you could also think about cultural products in that perhaps what we learn about mental illness through movies, through music, through art forms. My understanding is that culture shapes our understanding of mental health partly through what we listen to, what we watch, what we enjoy doing, as well as the upbringing that we've experienced in our home life. So we might adopt views of mental illness early in life that align with the folks that raised us. But as you sort of go through life, we might pick up new insights about what mental illness looks like, how best to treat mental illness through things like the movies that we watch or the cartoons that we see on TV. One example might be stigma in part can extend from portrayals of severe mental illness in, for instance, cartoons. So what comes to mind would be something like Batman and the idea that villains in Batman are typically housed or typically stay at the Arkham Asylum, for instance. In other words, we might develop an enhanced stigma towards people with mental illness because of what we are sort of interpreting based on what we see. So it could be the case that we learn to maybe associate negative viewpoints, negative views, hyperstigma, in part because of kind of what we are exposed to.
Especially nowadays, growing up, what you see, what is in front of you on the TV, it really shapes who you are as a person, especially like who you grow into.
Personally, I want to say that I love Batman. definitely one of my favorite superheroes. But looking at how, as you mentioned, the villains coming from Arkham Asylum and Batman has to take down these people because they are causing evil to Gotham City. And all the people who are housed in Arkham Asylum are doing something bad and they have to be put in the asylum. Otherwise, they're going to do something bad. Even a couple years ago when the movie Joker came out, it's about this man named Arthur, and he has a mental illness, and he ends up not taking his medications, and as a result, the movie portrays that he kind of spirals into a chaotic manner. He ends up murdering three people in a subway. in this movie, kind of what we were talking about earlier, where there's this assumption that, you know, people with a mental illness, if they don't take their medications, they're going to do something bad. They're going to murder someone. They're going to rob a bank, or they're going to some sort of kind of stigmatized behavior. So I think that's a good point that you brought up, where there are so many cultural influences that we don't even think about in our lives, whether it's cartoons or Batman or even within our family. It can be so intertwined into our lives that we don't even notice them. Things can be so interconnected. I think it's important to discuss intersectionality as well. So would you be able to talk about how the sociology of mental illness addresses this intersectionality?
Sure, yeah. So think of intersectionality as proposing that systems of inequality, whether it be sexism, racism, classism, that all of these monumental macro-level social systems overlap rather than sort of exist independent of each other. So what that means is you might think of, let's say, stereotypes of a racial group. So if we, at the surface level, there might be, let's say, positive or negative stereotypes about some racial group. But if we dig a little deeper, we'll see that there are gender differences in how groups are stereotyped, meaning that, let's say, a woman of some ethno-racial background might be stereotyped in a different way than a man from that same sort of ethno-racial background. And so the way that intersectionality is informative, particularly in my own research, is identifying stressors. So think of events, circumstances, or conditions that are appraised as unpredictable that can harm a person or at least threaten a person's mental health. So in this case, stressors are not evenly distributed across the population. Rather, some groups are more exposed. Oftentimes, it's marginalized populations that are more exposed to stressors. But again, if we dig slightly deeper, we'll see that something like contact with the criminal legal system, which we could think of as a stressor, whether that be arrests, police stops, incarceration, that typically, when we are exposed to these types of circumstances, it harms our mental health. But intersectionality tells us that one's experience is going to be dependent on a person's race, class, gender, sexuality, religious background. So an example might be, in some of my own research, looking at a stressor in the form of family member incarceration. So this is a stressor that disproportionately affects, most specifically, African-American women. And so what the research tells us is that something like 40% of African-American women in the United States have exposure to the incarceration of at least one family member. So again, this would be a stressor that is uniquely racialized and gendered such that Black women are disproportionately exposed to it. And what that means is that one's response to that stressor might also be unique in that the types of resources that one has is also going to depend on the sort of intersectional status, meaning race, class, and gender. All in all, though, you could think of contact with the criminal legal system as a stressor that disproportionately affects, let's say, Black adults. But more narrowly, intersectionality might point out that this unique stressor in the form of family member incarceration typically is disproportionate among Black women. And it has mental health implications such that when a family member is removed from, let's say, a household, it sort of shifts. Most often, again, this is Black men that are removed from the household. It most often shifts greater responsibility onto Black women to, let's say, provide economically, socially, psychologically for folks in that same home. But that can certainly take a toll on people's mental health, and that is certainly what the research literature shows. But again, intersectionality is useful in thinking about how systems of inequality overlap to produce unique sort of experiences at the intersection of race, class, and gender, as well as other sort of social statuses.
How would you feel that it relates to the stigmas in the healthcare community, in your opinion?
Yeah, very good question. So I would again echo the idea that one's experience, if, for instance, if they're a healthcare worker, one's experience is going to be shaped by their race, class, gender. It might be that there's negative stereotypes against, let's say, a person's ethnic group, and that, again, if we dig slightly deeper, that those stereotypes might differ by gender. On the flip side, when it comes to access to healthcare, we know, for instance, that on average, marginalized populations are going to be less likely to access healthcare. And part of that is, let's say, reduced health insurance coverage or less income or lower levels of education. And that would be sort of an intersection of economic disadvantage, ethno-racial, as well as gender disadvantage that can preclude a person from seeking out, let's say, sort of a mental health care type of exposure or access. So consequently, I would say that so intersectionality plays a role in both the worker, let's say healthcare workers, as well as folks that are trying to access healthcare. To take it again one step further, it's probably the case that marginalized populations, even if they're able to access mental health care, might experience reduced quality of care, in addition to perhaps maybe the folks that they're more likely to seek in terms of mental health professionals. They might be expensive. They might, let's say, not have the insights to help a person through their difficulties as it relates to that person's race, class, and gender, such that it might be the case that differences in the status characteristics of a provider and a recipient of that healthcare might diverge. And that might also, let's say, not necessarily benefit the person that is seeking out care.
How do you think healthcare professionals can then kind of integrate that sociological perspective into their work and use that to better address mental health issues?
Sure. So I would first start by saying that there are social determinants of health, whether physical or mental health, that matter beyond, let's say, what, let's say, a medical professional can treat. In other words, it's unlikely that if a person receives a diagnosis and are subsequently treated by a medical professional, that that treatment is not necessarily going to cure the social problems that exist in that person's world, whether it related to marriage, kids, these types of sort of experiences as an individual. But I would say that one way that medical professionals might bring in... That's kind of weird, right?
Fire alarm.
All right. Okay.
I have never sat through a fire alarm in the U.
All right, we're back. So we just had a fire alarm. Anyone want to talk about their feelings?
I felt like we exited safely and that it was, you know, everything went according to plan.
There's a staircase right nearby. It was nice.
We made it.
Yeah, we did.
Because we have an episode to record.
Yes, we do.
That's right.
All right. So Dr. Talbert was talking about kind of the approach that current healthcare professionals can implement using the sociological perspective, touched on the social determinants of health, how physicians may encounter difficulties treating a patient for a condition or a disease, because that disease may have other societal factors and determinants on that patient and on the community as a whole. Jumping more back onto your teaching, how do you approach mental illness in a way that promotes understanding and reduces stigma among students? It's definitely hard when you're not in a space that promotes that type of conversation, or you have to go to a place that promotes that type of conversation. So how in your class do you create that space?
Sure. I think partly one way that I try to create that space is by talking about just the prevalence of mental illness or poor mental health in general. The idea that everybody has bad days, but that in and of itself isn't necessarily representative of, let's say, poor mental health. So I'd say first, again, talking about the prevalence of, let's say, anxiety disorders being like the most common type of mental illness. Perhaps learning that this is more common than maybe is talked about might reduce stigma associated with, let's say, seeking help. And such that people might be able to see themselves in, let's say, whatever it is that we're talking about in a given class. They might be able to better recognize when they are experiencing poor mental health. And they might be able to identify sort of factors, again, that are beyond their control that are mattering for that person's mental health. So again, prevalence would be one way to sort of reduce the stigma, talking about the prevalence. Also talking about different outlets or better ways to cope with stress, something like social support or the people that we talk to when we have a bad day. Ensuring that folks have those sorts of outlets, or at least that the information or the knowledge that, let's say, having access to social networks typically benefits a person, or in other words, protects their mental health against something like stress. Those would be sort of ways that I typically approach mental health and illness in the course.
And have you observed any shifts in student perspectives on mental health over the duration of your course?
I would say yes. I think that maybe if you've never taken a sociology of mental illness course, that you might come into the course thinking that, let's say, maybe poor mental health is not as common as one might anticipate prior to joining the class, or that because the biomedical model has so much weight attached to it, it's most likely the case that we as humans that maybe have not taken a mental illness course, that we're more likely to rely on a biomedical perspective on mental illness. And what that means is perhaps somebody that's experiencing poor mental health might think that the reason they're experiencing that poor mental health is some sort of, let's say, brain chemistry off balance or something that is biological in their body that is sort of causing them to experience this disease. Whereas at the end of the semester, ideally, students have learned that certainly it can be the case that, let's say, malfunctioning in brain chemistry might matter for, let's say, a person's mood, but that there are these other broader social causes, including, again, what statues, for instance, that we're walking by on a daily basis, whether cars cut us off on our route to school, that these sorts of events or circumstances also matter for a person's mental health, and that it's important to learn how you best cope with something like stress.
There's so much that goes into it. The smallest things can really affect so many things in a person's mental health or just your overall thinking. It's really interesting. And to bounce back into your research, what are some current trends or challenges in the sociological study of mental illness, and how can they be addressed?
Good question. So partly, some of my research investigates what's called the black-white mental health paradox. And so this pattern in the data is called a paradox because, on average, Black Americans have similar or better mental health, let's say, on average, compared to white Americans. And so a challenge in the research literature is trying to explain what is it that, let's say, Black Americans are drawing upon to protect their mental health to a greater degree than, let's say, white Americans on average. And so a challenge here is, first, maybe we're not measuring mental health in a way that is culturally specific enough to different groups. And so a way to get around, let's say, maybe the questionnaires that we are providing people aren't necessarily resonating with them. In other words, perhaps questionnaires are better suited to more privileged populations on the basis of race, class, and gender. And so a challenge here is sort of ensuring that what we're measuring is, again, a person's mental health, that the questions that are being addressed by, let's say, a respondent are a reflection of, let's say, the types of symbols or language that group uses to talk about poor mental health. So a way to get around this would be, let's say, to use multiple measures of a person's mental health if we're going to try to identify, let's say, the patterning of mental illness, as well as what it is about some social factor that predicts a person's mental health. One strategy would, again, be using multiple measures of mental health, whether that be self-assessed mental health, let's say something like a generalized distress measure, which is where people answer questions about, let's say, how they've been functioning in the past week, as well as, let's say, whether they have been diagnosed with some form of mental illness, that if we better measure mental health using multiple measures, then perhaps we're better able to address these broader questions. In other words, how is it that one group is more resilient than another, at least on average? And in doing so, we can sort of reduce the stigma attached to poor mental health and better explain what it is about society that matters for our mental health.
As we near the end of this episode, do you have any final thoughts or comments?
I mean, I've enjoyed being with you all. Thank you for the opportunity. I think that the Sociology of Mental Illness course will be offered in the fall of next year, and please feel free to take it.
Thank you so much for coming. It was a lot to learn. It was very interesting. Thank you.
And to our audience, thank you so much for listening. If you would like to learn more about Medical Minds Matter, you can check out medicalmindsmatter.org and the national organization on Instagram at Medical Minds Matter, or you can follow the UConn chapter at MMM_UConn. If you're a student at UConn, email UConnMedicalMindsMatter@gmail.com to get added to the mailing list that has information about our upcoming general body meetings. Until next time, I'm Keshav.
And I'm Ishika.
And you are listening to The Medical Minds.